28436. My co-counsel, Mr. Freeman, has been extremely ill with diverticulitis and surgery and could not attend today. Extends his apologies. This case presents a two-step argument. The first argument is that the lineal heir can bring the claims that were brought in the complaint. That is pursuant to 1321.201 that allows damages for death. You can bring damages for the injuries and the death. The claims went exactly to that, to the damages and the injuries that led to Cora Fletcher's death. The court was incorrect to dismiss them out, stating the wrong plaintiff had brought them. The second point is, even if it could not be brought by the plaintiff led, the amendment of the plaintiff should have then been allowed. It didn't change the claims. It didn't change or add a defendant. It didn't bring in anybody that hadn't been on notice. It added a plaintiff to clarify a technicality from the statutes and that the court had requested be clarified. It didn't add any new claims. In fact, the court commented that it's exactly the same claims that were brought in the complaint. Well, of course it was, because couldn't amend back otherwise. So the issue became then, if the amendment were permitted, would they relate back? And the court varied a little bit on it, on its second order relating to that. It is clear it should relate back. There is no harm to the defendants in that. There is no new defendant named. It is a technical amendment to add the representative of the estate. It is not adding a new plaintiff.
Well, wait a minute, Ms. Gowdy. If a new plaintiff, a new entity has to enter to assert a claim that was not previously before the court and has the right to assert a claim, why isn't that extremely prejudicial to a defendant who's relying upon the statute of limitations?
It is not prejudicial because it is a technicality. It is simply the representative, which is made even more ironic in that the representative of that estate is now Jeffrey Fletcher. It is not prejudicial. They have not shown any prejudice other than that they would not have won their original motion for dismissal, which was based because that plaintiff wasn't there. It is very akin to the case in the Van Schett case, in which another plaintiff was brought in the interest of justice so that the merits of the claims can have been resolved. There has been absolutely no addressing of the merits of the claims. Secondly, the case cited by the people, the Ibraman case, says only if the addition constitutes a severe change in plan of state would it not relate back. It didn't. It should have been permitted. The amendment should have been liberally persuaded as the rule permits, and the relation back should have been included and the case proceed.
Well, Ibrahimi says that if you change the plaintiff's capacity or status, that's an amendment that doesn't relate back. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. So how is this something other than is this a change in capacity or status only?
No, it is the addition of the representative of Cora Fletcher's estate, of which Mr. Fletcher was the only lineal heir.
Gowdy, let me pick up on Judge Casewell's question. The Ibrahimi case also says that refers to the substitution of a real party in interest to a previously asserted claim. Is that what we have here?
I'm working on it. What we have here is not a substitution as a real party in interest as well as so much as an addition of a real party in interest. Both Mr. Fletcher as the heir and Betsy Fletcher had the capacity to be the plaintiffs in this case. There were varying claims.
Well, if the district court was correct that Mr. Fletcher did not have the authority to bring the claims that were dismissed, then the only question that's left is who would be able to bring those claims and when. Isn't that correct?
Let me take that back then. I understand what you're saying. The only claim as the complaint was drafted and was labeled, that the court could have been correct in that was, I believe, count two that was labeled a survival claim. The rest of the claims were negligence resulting in injury and death claims that clearly fall under the lineal heir claims. So the addition of Betsy would revive claim two, count two. But the rest of the claims, Jeffrey Fletcher had the capacity, this cleared up a legal issue that the court addressed and would have permitted the case to proceed on its merits.
So let me come back to my question then. Would the substitution of the estate for Jeffrey Fletcher in connection with any of the claims constitute the substitution of a real party in interest?
No, it's not a substitution except for claim two, count two. The other counts, it was an addition of it. It was an original name plaintiff is basically a pseudonym for the actual in this particular case, but especially with the relationship of the plaintiffs. The claims brought, again, it's important that the merits were never raised because that goes into what gets analyzed in allowing amendment of a claim. Secondly, the arguments as to identity go only to if you're adding a defendant. Someone new has not been brought into the case previously, was not on notice that this case would have been brought. There is no harm to the defendant in this matter for allowing the amendment. And if there are no further questions, I would reserve my time for rebuttal.
And I have a question for you, Ms. Gowdy. Under Ibrahimi, there's a statement there that the court makes that an amendment, the addition of a new party plaintiff, has to meet the criteria of Rule 15C, not just 15A, which allows liberal amendment, but has to meet 15C. Do you agree with that?
15C, the language of 15C goes to adding a defendant, a person brought in on notice. And then it analogizes it to plaintiff. There isn't in the rule anything bringing in another plaintiff as a prohibition under 15C, except by some case law analogy that uses a more federal practice in a case out of Wisconsin. 15C goes into defendants being brought in that we're not.
I realize the language of 15C does do that, but there's a statement from Ibrahimi that says that when you amend to allow to bring in a new party plaintiff, you have to meet 15C as well. That's my question. Do you agree with that statement or not? That you have to meet 15C when you bring in a new plaintiff?
If the interests of justice are in alignment with that, yes. If the interests of justice are not served and it's simply a technical prohibition against amending, no, I don't agree with it. The Benton versus Adams case goes into various reasons for denying these amendments, and they all go to dilatory or bad faith actions by the plaintiffs, undue delay, bad faith, dilatory actions, or futility. None of those occurred here except that the judge ruled it would be futile because he said it would not relate back, and it should relate back.
How is it not dilatory in that this proper plaintiff was known from the beginning? I mean, it's clear from the statute that the survival claims can only be brought by the estate.
And I can see
that as dilatory.
And I can see that as to count two. However, it is the position of the plaintiffs that is the lineal descendant. Jeffrey Fletcher had the standing to bring claims that were involved injury or death in tort, and those were the other five claims.
He had the right to bring a claim other than wrongful death. What you're saying?
The statute states that he can bring wrongful death includes injury and suffering leading to death, yes.
It is harm. That is the element of the claim. That's how the damage is determined in a wrongful death claim. It's the damages that he suffered. These other claims seem to relate to the harm suffered by the decedent.
It does.
And you think he's entitled to bring those?
I do.
Do you have any authority for that proposition? We haven't been able to find it, but I can...
Just the language of 1321.201, Your Honor. It's clear from the statute, and then the case law, even going back, I went back to as far as 1947, set it out aside, but what the difference was is this was pled for the damages because of her injury and death. And those clearly are what were pled in everything but count two.
Are you saying that you would voluntarily limit your damages to those available under the wrongful death statute under all of these claims for relief? Or are you seeking different damages?
We are seeking different damages by bringing in the amendment to bring in the representative of the personal state. What I was stating was it was not dilatory in how the case was pled originally.
I'm still trying to get to Judge Nieto's question, which is, aren't all of these claims, except the wrongful death claim itself, claims that the decedent could have brought had she survived, the breach of contract, the CCCA claim, the other claims that you've set forth besides wrongful death, aren't those claims that she could have brought? And if they are, why aren't they simply just survival claims? And what I'm asking you is, are you willing to limit your damages to just those damages recoverable in a wrongful death claim and just assert their different theories for getting there? I'm not clear here at all. I'm sorry.
Okay. The difficulty in that is that the survival claim has some specific limitations on the damages as well, including, and the wrongful death does permit the pain and suffering. And the pain and suffering is one of the largest parts of the merits of this case of what that woman has suffered and what she went through and why the suit was brought. So I'm not willing to limit the pain and suffering, no. Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, I am Ron Nimero, number 15178. I represent the appellee, Life Care Centers of America, doing business as Heritage Park Center. I noticed with some chagrin this morning as I was preparing that on the title page of my answer brief, I identified us as the appellant. I hope this does not cause confusion. This case involves two pretty straightforward issues and a miscellany of somewhat less straightforward ones. The first straightforward issue is whether the trial court correctly dismissed the non-wrongful death claims brought by Jeffrey Fletcher. The second straightforward issue is whether the plaintiff's motion to amend to add a new plaintiff, Mr. Fletcher's wife, to assert as personal representative of the decedent's estate the claims that the judge found Jeffrey Fletcher lacked standing for, whether that decision was incorrect. And the third, the category of a miscellany of less straightforward issues, involves whether all the claims that Ms. Fletcher was attempting to bring, whether all those claims except for the survival claims, are cognizable under Colorado law, and they're not. As to that last category, the miscellany of less straightforward issues, I'll stand on the briefs. Suffice it to say that the plaintiff doesn't make a compelling argument that the court erred in dismissing the non-wrongful death claims brought by Jeffrey Fletcher. I think the questions of this court were dead on, that the wrongful death statute says who can bring wrongful death claims. The survival statute says who can bring survival claims. Wrongful death claims can be brought by the heirs delineated in the statute, of whom Jeffrey Fletcher is one. And survival claims belong to the estate, and therefore can only be brought by the personal representative of the estate who embodies the estate.
Let's talk, Mr. Nimero, if you can, about which of these claims are survival claims and which are not.
The only claim that is a wrongful death claim, well, the two claims that are wrongful death claims are the negligence claim and the negligence per se claim. The rest of the claims are claims which, as Judge Nieto pointed out, could have been brought by Cora Fletcher had she lived. Therefore, they're the property of the estate and should have been brought by the personal representative. Th- there was a question that Judge Taubman asked, and that was whether bringing in Ms. Fletcher was simply a change in, was simply bringing in a party, the real party in interest, such that it should relate back. The Espinosa case, and I think it's the one with the S and not the Z, provides that you can't relate back to a case. You can't, there's no relation back where the initial claims were brought by someone who lacked standing. The initial claims here were brought by someone who lacked standing, and that was Jeffrey Fletcher bringing the survival claims. Those are, I'm sorry.
Mr. Nimero, could you explain the distinction between those two rules of law that you just explained? Because if a party, if a complaint is brought by somebody who's not the real party in interest, isn't there always going to be a lack of standing?
No. Because as a case proceeds, a party that was a real party in interest could lose, could be replaced by a party that had the real party in interest. So I believe the Ibrahimi case is an example of that, where there was an assignment. But I can envision cases where they were initially brought by someone who was a real party in interest, who and ceased to be. For example, I think
bankruptcy situation would be a case in point, wouldn't it?
Oh, I think so. Or a death.
So if you had someone who was a real party in interest, and then as Judge Casebolt is suggesting there was a bankruptcy, then somebody could be substituted and the case could proceed with that new party.
That would be a change in capacity. It would be the same legal player, but with a different face behind the mask. Here, there's not just a change. There was, as appellant candidly admits, an addition of a party. It's not a substitution of a party. There were more plaintiffs. There would have been more plaintiffs at the end of the amendment than there were at the beginning.
Well, let me pose to you the same question that I posed to your opposing counsel. If the court, the district court, were correct that the in dismissing all the claims except the wrongful death claims, then the purpose of the amendment is to add, or could it be viewed that the purpose of the amendment would be to add a real party in interest to pursue the claims on behalf of the estate? Then we're talking about a situation where we're not adding plaintiffs, but where there is really a substitution of plaintiffs.
Well, and I think that goes to the point that here the claims brought by the personal representative would be time barred, but for the relation back. And that's why it's important to see that the initial claims were a legal nullity. So what's going on here is an attempt to skirt the statute of limitations, which I believe was the point in the other Espinosa. I've forgotten which case discusses that. But 15C is not to be an avenue around the statute of limitations.
Well, 15C really doesn't apply at all, as was discussed before, because that applies to amending a complaint with regard to defendants, adding a defendant.
Not according to the case law of this court. The Doe versus Heidler case also provides that 15C applies to adding a plaintiff.
Right, it has been extended by case law, but not by the plain language of 15C doesn't extend to, not apply to adding or substituting a plaintiff.
But it's long been the law, I think, since the 1980s, that the rule has been interpreted in that way. I think Doe versus Heidler is 2001. Ibrahimi is 1989 and provides the same, that 15C relates, applies. So it would be a great departure from this law, this court's rulings, if that were to change with this case. The trial court was correct, then, in dismissing all but the wrongful death claims that Jeffrey Fletcher brought, and in denying the motion to amend to add a new plaintiff whose claims would have been time barred. The question that Judge Nieto asked about was whether there was dilatoriness here. The answer's got to be yes. Here, Betsy Fletcher was Jeffrey Fletcher's wife. She was named the personal representative within a month or two after Cora Fletcher's death, and there's been no suggestion on the record as to why there was any delay. All the reasonable inferences would suggest there should have been no delay at all. If there's no questions, I have nothing further to add. And I would ask that the court affirm the trial court.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. When you go and look at the actual language of 1320.202, the wrongful death statute, it states that the damager is liable for the wrongful act, neglect, or default, and it goes into unskillful behavior and actions of people that led to her death. In that particular case, this complaint was properly pled as far as the wrongful death counts, which were, I believe, are 1, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So for those counts, the judge was incorrect in dismissing them out to begin with, because it does not go to the effect of what the statute was designed to do. The statute must be applied in a manner that gives effect to the legislative purpose in line, and the legislative purpose was to overcome the common law prohibition against your death, your rights to damages at death ending at death.
The difference between... No one's, as I understand it, disputing the right of Mr. Fletcher to bring that claim. So that's the wrongful death claim, negligence per se, not being questioned here. But those claims that the decedent could have brought, which would include her own pain and suffering up until the time of her death, that's a survivor claim, is it not?
And that is count two, yes.
Are you acknowledging then that count two is barred?
Count two is a survivor claim. Count two would only be barred if the amendment back would not be permitted.
So now let's talk about the other claims. You said 1, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Which numbers are the negligence and negligence per se claims?
I believe it's 1, 3, 4 are all negligence and wrongful death, and I believe 5 and 5 is a CCPA, a Consumer Protection Act, in which he is brought as her heir, and as someone who suffered as a consumer for Mr. Fletcher, and 6 was as a third-party beneficiary.
Well, let's talk about the CCPA claim for a moment. Wouldn't the decedent have been able to bring a claim for a CCPA violation?
Yes.
So that is not a claim that inures to anybody but her, is it?
As it was pled, it inured to her heir, because it was part of the unskillfulness that brings wrongful death damages.
That's where I'm having trouble following you, Ms. Gowdy, because if it's a theory of law that you want to plead and say they have, part of the negligence per se claim is that you violated the CCPA Act.
Right.
I don't think there's any question about what you can pursue that theory. But can you recover the damages of the decedent that she would have incurred up until the time of her death? That's the issue. That's what a survivorship claim is. And that's why I'm having real trouble following you. Please go ahead and finish.
I understand, because the survivor claim has limitations on its damages, on punitives, on various other things.
Right, you can't recover those for that. I understand that.
Right, and then so the CCPA was brought because of the suffering. It went into the language of the unskillfulness going into the cause of her death by the administering Paxil, so she died starved to death. There are claims, and there are merits here.
But no one's disputing that. No one's disputing that she, if she can prove her claims, if Mr. Fletcher can prove his claims. But what's being disputed is the right to recover up until the time of her death. And if it's a right that belonged to the decedent only, I'm at a loss to understand how you can claim that your client can bring that claim when it belonged to the decedent. clearly the Wrongful Death Act belongs to him, no question. But how does the, how do these other claims belong to him as opposed to belonging to the decedent?
You look at this plain language of the statute, it says unskillfulness, they all related to the unskillfulness. And that's where the pleading came from. The amendment back honors what the courts have said, says fine, we are adding a plant, we are adding the representative as party for Jeffrey Fletcher. It allows the merits to go forward with justice, and it matches the needs of this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments this afternoon. Court will be in recess, and the bailiff may sign.